Hello, I'm Pat Caporale. This is number 0343, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0343. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Bill Bogart, author of Off the Street, Legalizing Drugs. He talks about the legalization of marijuana.
Obviously, because it remains an illegal drug right now, you have to be careful about making sure that you're getting quality marijuana and there's not bad stuff mixed into it. But when it's legalized and regulated, and that's one of the reasons for legalizing and regulating, there'll be quality assurance. So people will know how much what they're getting and the strength of it, etc. Now, the problem arises with frequent users. That is, daily or more than daily. There is evidence it can result in things like cognitive impairment. It can degrade performance generally.
NASA expert Rod Pyle is back on the program, this time on the mystery of space music.
This was a Science Channel show that came out a few weeks ago or a month ago, and they talk about this odd sound. It sounds like music or something strange heard by some of the Apollo astronauts as they're going around the backside of the moon. Now, as we all know, when you're going around the backside of the moon, you're cut off from Earth contact, so you shouldn't be getting any radio chatter or any radio messages of any kind unless they're coming from, cue the Echoplex, somewhere else, right? So that in itself is a weird thing.
Taylor Bayuth is the author of How to Steal the Mona Lisa and Six Other World-Famous Treasures.
Yes, it's just so much easier than we can imagine. I mean, we see these movies where you have, you know, crisscrossing laser beams and you have, you know, thermal, you know, heat detection cameras and paintings that are sitting on top of scales that, you know, slightest, you know, nudge and they set off an alarm system. That's just really not the case. And in my research, I found that most of these museums are operating off of security circa 1990.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. And, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0343 was Pat Caporelli, a media manager at Fiat Chrysler. And one of the sweetest human beings you will ever come across. Thank you very much, Pat, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? And let's start off with a twisted tale of a previously married couple. The then-married couple, both graduates of elite California law schools, were convicted of felonies and went to jail briefly 2 years ago for a criminal scheme that was inexplicably tawdry. And in February of this year, they lost a resultant civil lawsuit for $5.7 million to the scheme's victim. Now, a woman at their child's school had referred to the lawyer's son as slow, which enraged Kent Easter. He's a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley, and his then-wife, Jill, who was a graduate in the law department at UCLA. Now, they retaliated by planting drugs and paraphernalia in Kelly Peters' car, and then a man identified via circumstantial evidence as Kent, with an accent as if from India, called in a DUI tip to police, resulting in Peters' arrest. Now, according to Peters, neither perpetrator had ever expressed remorse, and although Kent admittedly said that it was stupidity what he had done, he now complains that Peters does not deserve her windfall like a Powerball winner, he said. Okay, so while it may not be accurate to characterize their child as slow, it is definitely clear that his parents aren't too swift. Perhaps medical scientists should study whether or not stupidity is genetic. And it was just a couple of weeks ago on Stuff File program number 0341, When we told you about a woman coming through customs at JFK Airport in New York who got caught with a half a pound of cocaine in her vagina. Well, she's an amateur compared to the woman in this story. A 24-year-old Colombian woman was arrested at Frankfurt Airport after she was found to be carrying a kilo of cocaine inside her breasts. Not between her breasts, inside her breasts. Airport officials became suspicious after they found fresh operation scars below the woman's breast during a search when she complained of severe pain. The woman admitted to carrying drugs, which had been inserted into her body during a hastily arranged operation. She was sent to a local hospital where doctors removed two 500-gram lumps of cocaine wrapped in plastic from each of her breasts. This is the first case in Germany in which drugs had been smuggled in this fashion, a spokesperson said. The woman, who said she has three children in Colombia, where she worked in agriculture, will be charged with drug trafficking and faces jail time. Okay, so she got caught because she complained about the pain. Doesn't it make you wonder if this method has worked before? And if so, how many times? Now customs officials will have to look more closely at large-breasted women. Yeah, that's never happened before. Meanwhile, 72-year-old Vicky Layton announced her retirement recently in Benidorm, Spain, over health concerns. But the lady's 30-year run in her one-of-a-kind Sticky Vicky magic show can hardly be forgotten by the 6 million fans who have witnessed it. Trained as a ballerina but emulating magicians who pull rabbits out of top hats, Vicky extracted an impressive array of items also from the body cavity that occasionally makes the news here, and it indeed made a brief appearance in the previous story. One review in a Spanish newspaper described a typical inventory: fluffy flags, flowers, ping pong balls, sausages, eggs, a string of razor blades, a bottle, and a light bulb that was aglow. Clearly, at her age, with an act running 30 years, Vicky has earned her retirement. But with the previous story still fresh in your mind, has anybody given thought to what she might have been able to smuggle through customs over the years? Or perhaps she just used her talent for good instead of evil. Wow, now I'm getting an image of a whole new superhero. Yeah. And a morning rush hour crash on Highway 290 in Houston led to a bizarre standoff between police and a naked woman standing atop a semi-truck. The Greater Houston Traffic and Emergency Management Center reported a crash involving three vehicles just before 9 a.m., and the scene took a turn for the bizarre when a woman climbed atop a stopped semi-truck and disrobed. The woman was seen on the traffic cameras sitting nude atop the big rig and occasionally standing up to dance. Traffic on both sides of the freeway came to a halt for nearly 2 hours while police and firefighters attempted to talk the woman down from the truck. The woman was coaxed into a ladder truck basket at around 11 a.m., and the accident was cleared by 11:30. The woman's motive for her truck-top activities were unclear, but witness accounts indicated that she and the semi-truck were both involved in the crash. You know, I'm sure the truck driver must have taken a whole bunch of pictures, you know, to give his insurance company just the right vantage point of what took place for the accident report. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, when is it time to kick your smoking habit, you ask? When you hear stories like this next one. A man broke into a store to get a pack of cigarettes, but he did not steal it. Instead, he left the money on the counter. New Mexico police arrested a man who was accused of entering the convenience store and leaving behind $6 for the pack of cigarettes. 24-year-old Ellis C. Batista was charged with felony breaking and entering. Now, Batista went to the 24-hour convenience store at 3:30 a.m. One would believe that if a convenience store is indeed open 24 hours, that it would indeed be open 24 hours. It reminds me of an old joke where somebody said when they didn't open their store for 24 hours, they said, I never said it was in a row, but I digress. Anyway, to his disappointment, the store employee was not there and the door was locked. Batista broke the door and took his favorite pack of cigarettes. He then took out $6 to pay for them. Batista raised the money to the surveillance cameras to prove that he had paid it and left the store. Police said the surveillance camera also showed Batista knocking on the front door several times in an apparent attempt to get someone to open it. When nobody responded, he kicked the door in and broke it, according to a witness who called 911. You know, more and more countries and jurisdictions are banning smoking in prison, so Ellis may be in for a rude surprise once he's behind bars. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? As Canada is on the threshold of legalizing and regulating pot, many are asking, is marijuana safe and what are the facts? Bill Bogart, internationally recognized expert on regulating consumption and risky behavior, is back on the program. He has a new book coming out in November entitled Off the Street, Legalizing Drugs. Bill is on the line with us right now from Toronto. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again.
So, most welcome.
There are a lot of people on both sides of the issue who have questions, and I would assume have myths or believe in myths about the safety or lack of safety of marijuana. So what are the facts?
Well, I think the facts are these, Peter. First, let's deal with kids. A kid should be kept away from this drug, as they should be kept away from all drugs, tobacco, alcohol, and obviously other kinds of recreational drugs. So kids, you know, shouldn't be near it. And we've got a problem on our hands because statistics tell us that Canadian youth may be the highest consumers of pot in the developed world. These are UNICEF figures from 2013. So there's a real issue here about addressing children. And the belief of many, and I would subscribe to this belief, is that we'll actually do better in deterring kids from use once marijuana is legalized and regulated. And I can go into that, why that is, if you want me to. Now, when it comes to adults, I think it's very important to distinguish between infrequent and frequent use. If you're a casual marijuana user, a couple of times a month, etc., you're going to be fine. I mean, the evidence seems to be quite overwhelming that it's not harmful when used casually. Obviously, because it remains an illegal drug right now, you have to be careful about making sure that you're getting quality marijuana and there's not bad stuff mixed into it. But when it's legalized and regulated, and that's one of the reasons for legalizing and regulating, there'll be quality assurance. So people will know how much what they're getting and the strength of it, et cetera. Now, the problem arises with frequent users, that is daily or more than daily. There is evidence that it can result in things like cognitive impairment. It can degrade performance generally. People, if they're smoking it, can get themselves into problems with respiratory issues. And then we also have the issue of driving. Like all drugs, the psychoactive drugs, one has to be extremely careful in terms of using the drug and then operating a motor vehicle. And that certainly is also the case with alcohol. And there are definitely issues around that. It's clearly an offense to drive while impaired, whether it's by alcohol or drugs. But there's some going back and forth about what the best methods of detection are in terms of, first of all, establishing what level of impairment is not permissible, and then secondly, detecting that level of impairment. So, as you know, Bill Blair, the former chief of police of Toronto, is now a Liberal MP, and he's in charge of the marijuana file and bringing forth recommendations. And I think we'll hear lots from him about prohibitions against driving from impaired and how to detect impairment, because this is a very important issue.
Well, let me ask this question about going back to kids. I understand children should not be using marijuana, but what about a situation where they're in the room where marijuana is being consumed? Is there any concern about any secondhand effects from someone being in a room where there is marijuana being smoked?
Well, you know, I mean, I think if it's a small room and there's no ventilation, I mean, it's possible that a kid could get high. I mean, it's possible that an adult could get high. So, yeah, I think there'd be concerns about that. Also, Peter, you know, anybody who's had a child knows that the notion of do as I say, don't do as I do really works very well. So if the parents are regular pot users and they're trying to dissuade the child from using pot altogether, they're going to have an uphill battle. Just as, you know, parents set the tone for children in terms of consumption of alcohol.
Now, here in Canada and also in the United States, it varies from place to place when it comes to the sale of alcohol.
Yes.
You can get, for instance, here in Quebec, you can get beer in any corner store, but you have to go to the liquor board to get spirits and wines. In Ontario,
right.
you have to, you know, it's different, and it differs across the country. It also differs in the United States. Have we learned anything from prohibition back in the day in the United States and the return of alcohol as a legal product as to how marijuana will now be sold as a legal product and by whom?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, like you say, I mean, once a prohibition was abolished, then a number of regulatory schemes emerged, both in the United States and Canada. And, you know, I think we're waiting for Bill Blair on this one. As you know, Kathleen Wynne, the Premier of Ontario, has voiced the view of, well, maybe we could sell it in the LCBOs, which is Ontario's regulated retail outlet for beer and alcohol. And as you also know, in Ontario, that's the only place you can purchase beer and liquor and so on. But, you know, it might not be a bad thing, and it might not be a bad thing if we said, well, look, at however you can sell beer and alcohol, that's how you can sell pot, and we'll do this for 2 years and then see how it goes. In Ontario, I think that might be an easier recommendation because, for better or for worse, we have a pretty tightly regulated retail arrangement. Other provinces and other folks in other provinces say, well, you know, we're not sure that we want pot being sold at the corner store because, again, that may make it too accessible for kids, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you know, people are allowed to make their own wine and in some cases make their own beer for their own personal consumption. Marijuana is something that many people over the years have grown anyway. Will that still be allowed or should that still be allowed?
Well, again, that's a really good question. Now, that might bring us to medical marijuana, meaning, first of all, I want to say that you know, whatever the negatives of marijuana can be, if consumed, as I said, frequently, there are therapeutic aspects to marijuana. Now, they're not known in a really rigorous way because it's been a legal drug. We haven't done the research that really needs to be done, but we know that a lot of people believe that there are medicinal values, and marijuana for medicinal purposes has been legal now since about 2001. And that brings me to the whole point about people growing pot for their own consumption. That was possible under an arrangement before the Harper government. And because of a decision 2 weeks ago from the federal court, it's now also again possible if you have a license. So all of this is to say, Peter, that yes, we have some narrow situations in this country where people can grow their own pot for medicinal purposes. Now, what Bill Blair will say about all of this, you know, remains to be seen. I mean, I think, to me, I'm not so much concerned about people growing it in small amounts for their own use. As I said, I'm more concerned about them recognizing that under certain circumstances, marijuana can have negative consequences, including certainly in terms of impairing judgment while operating a motor vehicle.
One very quick question. Do you worry or do you think that there will be a situation, again, similar to prohibition in the United States, where something is legal in this country but not legal in the United States, that there could be a groundswell of business, you know, with trafficking going the other way?
Yeah, no. And a black market is a real issue for any number of reasons. One of which, as you say, that it, you know, if states in the United States don't move as quickly as we do, then there can be issues around the border. Although I note, Peter, that right now several states in the United States are actually ahead and have gone ahead and legalized and regulated. But the other thing I think about preventing contraband is, you know, that there's a whole notion of we'll tax it in order to drive a revenue stream and also suppress excessive use. And I'm for that. I think there's room for that. But you don't want to set the tax and the cost of the product so high that, in fact, then the black market moves back in again. And, you know, we saw some of those problems. Indeed, we're seeing some of those problems in terms of the taxation of tobacco.
Right. Your new book is coming out in November. It's called Off the Street, Legalizing Drugs. Bill, I thank you once again for being on the program with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Professor Bill Bogart, author of Off the Street, Legalizing Drugs. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0343, and you'll find links to Bill's website.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about music in space. Odd, mysterious music in space. Plus, we will tell you how to steal the Mona Lisa and six other world-famous treasures. We'll meet the author of that book. And, of course, we do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, plus lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program I also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Lynette Monday had a great job with the Federal General Accounting Office, but she also had a side job. She sat on the Board of Education in Prince George's County, Maryland. Now, together, the jobs paid $93,000 per year, but Monday has been found guilty of accepting more than $1,700 worth of free and reduced-price school lunches for her own child, which she received over 6 years. The lunch program is for low-income families. It has a $40,000 income cutoff. Monday's crimes were uncovered by a GAO audit. Now, when the jury read the first guilty verdict on the many charges she faced, Monday reacted so violently, she had to be removed from the courtroom while the rest of the guilty verdicts were read. She faces as much as 49 years in jail when she's sentenced later. 49 years. Wow. That really ups the tactics of a school bully who steals lunch money, huh? Yikes. Talk about school bully lunch money, the next generation. Moving right along. We have a couple of stories here dealing with perps who are clearly not ready for primetime crime. Number one, 26-year-old Anthony Nemeth, seeking pain medication but lacking a prescription, leaped over a pharmacy counter at a Walgreens in Bradenton, Florida in February and demanded a supply. Customer David West, who is 25, standing at the counter with his girlfriend, ended the robbery with four quick punches, sending Nemeth to the floor. West is a competitive boxer and reportedly a former state champ. And number two, wheelchair user Betty Jeffrey, who is 76, was briefly the victim of a purse snatching in Pitsea, England in February. She appeared vulnerable, but in fact is a former national arm wrestling champion, and slugged the young female thief in the face, slowing her down and leading her to drop the purse as she fled. The bottom line here is, in both of these stories, if you're going to commit a crime, you really should be in better shape. Yeah. And we have a couple more criminals here who really didn't think their crimes through. Number one, 62-year-old Simon Chaplin thought he had cleverly evaded police near Hebron, England recently, thus avoiding a speeding ticket, by employing a do-it-yourself James Bond-style smokescreen device on his Peugeot sedan, facilitating a smoggy getaway. Now, initially, baffled police officers were forced to hang back. But of course, as the haze broke, they merely followed the smoke trail up ahead and caught Chaplin, who was convicted in Swansea Crown Court in February. And number two, a man who tried to vandalize a cafe in the Richmond suburb of Melbourne, Australia, in February, got away. But surveillance video showed that, in dousing the outside of the building with fire accelerant, he had also doused his own shoes and was spotted running off with his feet on fire. Yes. Oh, the fate of fleeing, flaming feet brings new meaning to a hot foot, doesn't it? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, you know, there are some stalwarts in the annals of journalism who lament that reporting just doesn't dig deep enough to get to the bottom of a story these days. That it's all stuff just on the surface, or low-hanging fruit, as it were. Sadly, we have a couple of stories that demonstrate this and clearly require more detail. Story number one, 24-year-old Andrew McNeil was arrested in Lincoln, Nebraska in January and charged with disturbing the peace. Now, according to the police report and lacking follow-up reporting by the local news outlets, McNeil was found at around 11 p.m., naked, and covered in sawdust. Now, folks, seriously, don't we need to know more about this than what I just told you? I have no further information than I just shared. That's the extent of the story. And story number two, 32-year-old Rob Moore was arrested for misdemeanor drug possession in Marathon, Florida in February. But he had only come to police attention when an officer heard him banging on the trunk of his car from the inside. Now, without follow-up reporting, Moore's story was that he was looking for something in the trunk, fell in, and couldn't get out. Really? Really? That's all the facts we have? Okay, no Pulitzer for you. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, let's go to our next guest, shall we? Newly declassified audio tapes have revealed that Apollo 10 astronauts heard outer space music as their spacecraft flew around the far side of the moon back in 1969. During the mission, the astronauts were on the part of the moon furthest from Earth where no one from NASA could see or hear them. The astronauts' conversations were kept under wraps for more than four decades. NASA historian Rod Pyle is back on the show, this time to talk about this and other topics in space. He joins us once again from California via Skype. Hi, Rod.
Hey, how you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks once again for being on the program. Now, this is not a big conspiracy theory or anything. This is not an Area 51 situation. This is just something that was classified for a long time that's no longer classified. So what's the deal?
Well, it actually is kind of in middle territory. This was a Science Channel show, quote, Science Channel, unquote, show, that came out a few weeks ago or a month ago, called, I think, NASA's Unexplained Files or something like that. And they talk about this odd sound. It sounds like music or something strange heard by some of the Apollo astronauts. They mentioned Apollo 10. It also happened on Apollo 11 and maybe one other mission. It was going around the backside of the moon. Now, as we all know, when you're going around the backside of the moon, you're cut off from Earth contact, so you shouldn't be getting any radio chatter or any radio messages of any kind, unless they're coming from, cue the Echoplex, somewhere else, right? So that in itself is a weird thing. So let me just jump back for a second to the declassifying part. NASA came out with an announcement very shortly after this started becoming an internet sensation and said, we just want to remind everybody this material's been available literally since weeks after the flight when we had the transcripts put into paper. We only got around to putting it on the web a few months ago because we don't have very much money for this kind of stuff. And I did see these transcripts back in the, I think it was the mid-90s, and I was working on a project. So it's been there. It's just only recently been put on the web. So it's not that it was declassified. It's just it takes them a long time with the money they've got to get through the stuff and actually get it all there.
Okay. So do we have any ideas as to what it could be? I'm sure there have been people who have theorized what it could be, including some of the astronauts who experienced this.
Yeah. And so you've got it happened on the flights which had two spacecraft. Apollo 8 was just the one spacecraft, the command module and the rocket, the service module. And they didn't experience this, but the Apollo 10 and 11 both had two spacecraft, the command and service module and the lunar module. And they'd separate, and then you'd start hearing this weird stuff. So when you look at these spacecraft, I mean, the command module alone has something like 3 million parts in it, and I forget how many miles of wire, but it's a lot. All kinds of, and this was the 60s, so back then we were just getting out of the vacuum tube age. So it was heavy electronics, transistors, everything high power, generating lots of heat, emitting a lot of radio frequency and electromagnetism and so forth. So the command module alone had, I think, 7 different transmitters. There was 2 for voice to go to the Earth, one at a backup to go to the lunar module. The lunar module had 2 radios to go back to the command module under Earth if necessary. There is a separate channel just to send telemetry back to Earth on a whole separate band just to tell it how the space, health of the spacecraft was and so forth. So you've got all these frequencies right adjacent to each other, and as you know, having been a radio, you can get this thing called, I think it's a beat frequency, where you get these things close together, you start getting these weird overlapping sounds. If you've ever listened to shortwave, you can amuse yourself just by tuning to a dead band and hearing all kinds of weird stuff out there. So these are very highly charged, electronically dense machines back in an age when shielding wasn't as good, filtering wasn't as good. This is all analog for the most part. So the lab tests they've done have demonstrated that this was coming from the machines themselves. Gene Cernan, who's the guy they quoted in that show, was spoken to afterwards and wrote a short piece about it saying, look, it was just noise. We were up there flying this low pass to the moon. This was a simulation run for the landing, basically, for Apollo 11. They were doing this low pass at the lunar surface, but not landing, trying to keep track of hundreds and hundreds of things. And these are test pilots. They're having the time of their life, and they say all kinds of stuff while they're up there. So basically, they said, well, what do you think? Should we talk about it when we come around the other side? Now let's tell them later. And it didn't even come up in the debriefing. So that's the story.
So much ado about nothing. It's sort of like the equivalent of an odd squeak in an older vehicle that you can't really find.
Kind of like that, or some kind of signal in the radio that you don't know if you're getting it from the spark plugs or from the car next to you or the big semi that's bearing down on your back bumper. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff. You know, radio's an imperfect science, and back then it was even less so.
And by the way, I spent about a decade working in shortwave, so I know exactly what you're talking about with shortwave frequencies. That's a whole kettle of fish on its own. I want to get to another item that is more recent in the news. Actually, before I get to that, since this information was, as NASA said, always out there, but they never put it on the web before, is there a lot of information that is out there that just hasn't been disseminated to the masses online?
There's miles of shelving of this stuff. Everything from the early days of the space race to the closing down of the space shuttle, there are boxes and boxes and containers full of paper. And it's interesting you bring this up, because I'm working on a book project right now. I've been looking for things, some of which have been digitized and put online, most of which haven't. So you're still, in this day and age, reduced to going in, looking through a card file sometimes, and then going into a big room, not quite on the scale of the end of the first Raiders of the Lost Ark, but you get the idea, of finding crate B27X and searching through it to try and find what you're looking for. And NASA's budget is about a tenth of what it was in the 60s, and they're running all these programs, so there just isn't a lot of money left over to scan all this stuff and put it up. So what we have up there is the best stuff and the material that TV programs and authors and journalists have been asking for over the years, but there's still reams and reams of material, motion picture footage, you name it, even photographs. There was a whole batch of photographs from the surface of the moon during the moonwalks that was released not too long ago because they just hadn't had time or money to put them up before.
So what you're saying is it's still important to be old enough to know how to use the Dewey Decimal System.
Yeah, you got to be able to use the card file. That I explained that to my kid a while ago. He looked at me like I had just fallen out of a tree, and he said, "That sounds horrible." And I said, "Well, compared to now, it was, yeah."
Anyway, the more recent news story that I wanted to get to very quickly is the recent return of Scott Kelly, one of the astronaut twins, and if you want to tell them apart, he's the one that's taller, after spending a year in space. So he started talking a little bit more now about the idea of maybe we are ready to go to Mars.
Yeah, and it's a valid point, you know. Now he's not a record holder. He's the American record holder. There is a Russian gentleman who spent, a cosmonaut who spent, I think, 470 days or something close to that on the Mir station. And boy, you know, if you think it's rough spending almost a year up on the International Space Station, that's a vacation paradise compared to Mir. That was a small, cramped, older space station. So that guy truly was one of those steely-eyed missile men. But it's pretty clear now that people can stay in space for months and months and up to a year at a time. And a Mars voyage, ideally somewhere between 7 months, 5 to 7 months each direction, plus whatever time you spend on the surface. So what he was getting at is, look, we know that the body can stay in zero G that long and be okay. We got to exercise while we're up there. We got to be careful because you do have bone loss. You have fluids moving around your body. You've got this kind of constant state of a slight head cold. Your eyes actually change shape over time. But all this stuff seems to be manageable. What we haven't figured out yet is how to deal with the severe radiation exposure they get once they leave the Earth's magnetic magnetosphere, which is what protects us from solar and cosmic energy, and how to protect them all the way out to Mars and back from that. But the other stuff, you know, the medical side of it seems to be in pretty good shape, and that's exciting. And he said he was ready to stay up there longer.
And I did say, kind of facetiously, the taller one, but I understand that the 3 inches he gained while he was in space, that evaporated literally within a day after returning back to Earth.
Yeah, the spine just goes back to, it's like, remember those things, those inversion tables we used to have where you'd hook your feet over a bar and then you'd hang upside down for a while and your spine would stretch out and you'd get imperceptibly taller over the period of a couple of hours if you were hardy enough to stay on that long, and then you stand up and you feel great and then you look the same after about another 2 hours. So that's the equivalent of what happened to him.
The idea of going to Mars, which is very important to Scott Kelly, is also important to you. I understand you have a new book coming out in June called Mars, The Next Frontier.
That's one of the best segues I've heard in years. Yes, I do. It's going to be a wonderful book. It's got about 40,000 words and over 300 pictures. It's one of those rare chances to do a coffee table book, which doesn't happen much anymore because they're expensive. So I've been crawling around JPL's archives and finding every high resolution reference I can and interviewing people. And actually, I've got some stuff that I've managed to pull out from private collections that hasn't been seen since the 70s on Viking and later Pathfinder. So that was really exciting to find this stuff with, you know, these are mission papers and guidelines and plans with coffee stains and pencil markup and all that kind of stuff. And that's when it gets really fun. So I'm excited about that.
Excellent. And I also understand you have another book coming out called Blueprint for a Battlestar. And we'll talk about that book and the Mars book, both when they come out closer to the time period in the summer. I thank you once again, Rod, for being on the program with us.
My pleasure. Have a good one.
NASA expert Rod Pyle. As I mentioned, he has two new books coming out this summer, Mars, The Next Frontier, and Blueprint for a Battlestar. We'll have him back on when they're released. And you can still get his previous titles, such as Curiosity, an inside look at the Mars rover mission and the people who made it happen. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0343, and you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dirigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. According to a Gallup poll, Americans believe the government regulates business too much. 49% of Americans say there's too much government regulation, while only 21% say there's too little regulation. Federal agencies like the Internal Revenue Service, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the National Labor Relations Board create so much red tape for job providers, many feel it's almost impossible to keep up to date with all the rules. So anyone who runs a business may find irony in the fact that the National Labor Relations Board itself has been found guilty of an unfair labor practice. That's right, a judge has ruled that when the NLRB moved its headquarters to a new building in Washington, D.C., the agency violated its duty to fully negotiate the terms of the move with the unions representing its own workers. Let's be fair, there's way too much government red tape today. When the NLRB can't even follow labor laws, something's seriously wrong. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
You're experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of How to Steal the Mona Lisa. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. We don't have any more time for Stuff File news on this program this week, unfortunately. The show just went by so quickly. I do have enough time to tell you that, of course, this program is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And also, we'd love to hear from you, especially if you're a relatively new listener to the Stuff File program. Drop us a line with your thoughts. You can email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and stuff again is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's peter@thestufffile.com. We'd love to hear from you, and we might even put your letters on the air in our mailbag section in a future show. So please drop me a line, peter@thestufffile.com. Now, on to our next guest on this edition of the Stuff File program. Movies often lead us to believe that only the most talented thieves would be able to successfully swipe a priceless work of art from a world-famous museum. But in the book, How to Steal the Mona Lisa and Six Other World-Famous Treasures, Taylor Bayouth says that such a scheme would actually be easier to pull off than one might think. Taylor joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles. Hi, Taylor.
How you doing?
Just tickety-boo, thanks for being on the program with us. So I'm just wondering, are you currently under surveillance as we speak?
Most likely. You know, I've had a lot of conversations with people about the amount of research that I've done and the likelihood that I'm on a watch list of some sort.
What led to you doing this in the first place?
I think it was a mix of my love for heist films, just like most, and then a trip to the Louvre to go see the Mona Lisa, which I spent a lot of time on that trip, you know, looking at the security and just kind of realizing how lax it really was. And then the idea for the book came, and it was really like 6 years after that when I started working on it.
While most of us would not go out and want to commit a crime, do you not agree that deep down inside a lot of us would like to think we could pull off the perfect crime?
Oh, I think so. Come on. I mean, it's the allure of, you know, having a piece of priceless and iconic artwork hanging on your living room wall. I mean, sure.
And that brings up another point, because you just mentioned the allure of having a priceless piece of art on your wall. One of the things I've never understood, by the way, about such high-profile crimes is that it's not like you can hang it in your living room. If you steal something this valuable, you pretty much have to hide it from the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for those, the small minority that would actually, you know, want to just hang on to it and not want to liquidate it or fence it, yeah, I mean, you could never really show it to anyone. I think people forget that most of the artwork they see, including the Mona Lisa and others just as iconic as that, have been stolen. And typically what happens to stolen artwork and artifact like that is it just winds right back up in the hands of the museum. And the reason why that happens is because the insurance companies that insure this artwork, you know, they have a checkered past of dealing with criminals, keeping the feds out, and paying out huge settlements to get that art back in the museums. And that's how these criminals make their money.
Okay, I kind of facetiously said at the beginning, you must be on a watch list, but seriously, did you ever concern yourself with drawing undue attention just because you were researching the idea of how to steal priceless works of art?
I mean, it's a really clever idea, and if it were the case, I wouldn't be able to be honest with you anyway, so I don't know how how confident you're going to be in my answer.
Because I'd be concerned, you know, nowadays we all do research. I mean, I do research to do this show on a regular basis. And sometimes I keep thinking, are my Google searches getting me in trouble somehow?
I mean, the Patriot Act, it runs far and deep. And, you know, when I was doing research for my chapter involving electromagnetic pulse devices, I was a little bit nervous. And in fact, I actually promised myself when I started doing this book that I was going to be only doing my research on encrypted lines, on Tor browsers, and, you know, incognito mode at the very least, but just pure laziness kind of got the better of me, and I know I've done some pretty, eyebrow-lifting searches. So, yeah, it's just a fact of life, I guess, these days.
When you do the research to put together a book like this, as you work through it, does it surprise you perhaps how easy it might be to pull off one of these heists you refer to? And conversely, why do you think it doesn't happen more often?
Yeah, those are two really good questions. The short answer to your first question is yes. It's just so much easier than we can imagine. I mean, we see these movies where you have, you know, crisscrossing laser beams, and you have, you know, thermal, you know, heat detection cameras, and you know, paintings that are sitting on top of scales that, you know, slightest, you know, nudge and they set off an alarm system. That's just really not the case. And in my research, I found that, you know, most of these museums are operating off of security, but, you know, security circa 1990, let's say. And there's a reason for that, right? The reason is that these museums are funded by donors and state and government money. So when you look at security for a museum, like the size of the Louvre, you have to consider that, you know, it's really the cost per square foot in terms of security. And these museums, in some cases, can be hundreds of thousands of square feet in size. So if you compare them to your typical Las Vegas casino, you're talking about one-tenth to one-hundredth the budget. So the fact of the matter is these pieces are not very well protected. They're surrounded by, you know, lax security personnel, and a lot of camera systems that are still recording on tape.
Now, again, the title is How to Steal the Mona Lisa, so that is kind of like the Holy Grail because it's such a famous painting. But you mentioned the Louvre just a few moments ago. Is it not possible that something like the Mona Lisa could draw attention to the fact that there are other arts, works of art in the Louvre that are probably extremely valuable as well, that are probably an easier catch than taking the high-profile biggest one that's in there, being Mona Lisa?
Definitely, and you know, there's you know, techniques and kind of tools of the trade in the book that you can use and apply to really any you know, any target. But this book is really it was really written for people who want to get after that big stuff: the Rodin's Thinker, King Tut's Golden Death Mask, you know, the Codex Lester, things like this.
So now that you've written the book, have you heard from any security forces, museums, or houses where works of art are contained, just questioning the idea of this book and maybe how they can better take care and protect their works of art?
You know, I haven't heard that yet. It's only been out for a week, and that would be wonderful if one of the byproducts of this book was better security at museums. You know, again, I'm not sure that those budgets are even there to stretch thinner than they already are, but that would be nice.
On the other side of the coin, do you worry that your book might be a primer for somebody who wants to pull off one of these heists?
No, I don't, because, I mean, the theme of this book is how to pull off a safe and well-calculated heist. It's none of these heists require violence of any kind. You know, I never suggest that you bring a weapon to any of these heists. And the idea is that if you, you know, plan far enough in advance, if you have the bankroll, if you have the patience, if you have the tenacity, then you can actually do this relatively safely. And as I said earlier, you know, 9 times out of 10, it really just ends right back in the hands of the public. So it's really, at the end of the day, a crime against these insurance companies.
When you talk about some of these crimes, I'm just curious to know, are they completely done by... or would they be completely done by someone who is looking to steal these events, or would there be some sort of inside component to this?
Do you mean like working with someone that works at or with these museums?
Yes.
Yeah, so 100% of the heists in the book are you can basically do on your own or with a team that you basically put together externally. So I didn't want to make any assumptions about what kind of relationships you could forge with people that actually work with in those museums or institutions. So, you know, for that reason, I tried to leave all of that out and really make it a, you know, kind of, you know, something that you could do no matter what the scenario was in terms of relationships.
What are some of the common mistakes that criminals make in pulling off or trying to pull off one of these huge heists?
You know, mostly it's ego, and so many heists they go smoothly, and the criminal gets out with the, you know, target item, and then, you know, weeks or months or years down the line they end up telling someone just out of sheer ego, and that happens time and time again. You've seen that. Beyond that, I would say just poor planning. You know, Not really having a solid understanding of what it means to properly stake out a building. So that means not days and not weeks, but months of reconnaissance to have a perfect idea of what everyone's schedule actually is, and being able to, you know, predict and anticipate any change in real time.
When you're lying in bed before you drift off to sleep, which major piece of work do you know in your mind think that's the one I want to steal?
Well, at this point, I guess I'm you know, thinking about, you know, what's next after this book. You know, I would love the opportunity to go to Amsterdam again, and you know, and check out, you know, one of the Van Goghs, maybe one of his bedroom paintings, which I've always loved that series.
Do you think any museum would let you do a book signing in the location?
Yeah, I've wondered about that. I should talk to my publicist.
The book is called How to Steal the Mona Lisa and Six Other World-Famous Treasures. It certainly is a unique concept for a book. I thank you very much, Taylor, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
All right, thanks so much, Peter.
Taylor Bayouth, author of How to Steal the Mona Lisa and Six Other World-Famous Treasures. You can find out more information by going to his Facebook page, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0343, and you'll find the link, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
An unobservant crook experienced instant justice after sticking up a cabbie in Reading, Pennsylvania. The robber was apparently too busy demanding money from the terrified driver to notice the police cruiser in the rearview mirror. Berks County Sheriff's Deputy Terry Ely was waiting at a traffic light when he noticed something odd. The taxi in front of his vehicle sat through several cycles of the traffic light. He didn't know about the drama unfolding in the cab until he approached the vehicle and found 18-year-old Victor Martinez Herrera waving a gun around. The security camera inside the cab recorded the drama as it unfolded. Martinez Herrera jumped into the back seat and immediately held a gun to driver Ralph Valletta's head while demanding money. A shaken Valletta handed over $11, telling the robber that he had only just started his shift and that's all the money he had. That's when the officer flashed his lights and approached the car. Martinez Herrera put up his hands and told Ely that he was carrying a fake gun. Police charged the unlucky teenage crook with robbery, terroristic threats, and simple assault. And by the way, you can go to the Stuff File Group Facebook page and see the actual dashboard cam. It's posted up there as the Idiot of the Day. Take a look at it. And if you're not a member of the Stuff File Group, just ask to join. Now, why? Oh, why? When you're committing a robbery in broad daylight, no less, would you not look around to check and see if a police car is right behind you? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0343. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0343. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR in Nashville, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.